I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for, so we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Nick, I am delighted to be with you, and you know, there's a lot bubbling up in me from our pre-recording check-in. How are you doing, first of all?
I'm doing great. Same for me. I've got loads of like pregnancy in my space between us, and in my heart, and my body feels very open and whole and big. So yeah, feeling alive, feeling honored to be in the space with you. And yeah, just this is like almost my best thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many topics we could go into today, and we're going to try and we made a kind of commitment. Let's try and cohere so that this conversation makes sense. I'm confident it will. But actually, before I ask you anything, could you just, this is a question, but could you just say like a little bit, just a brief, like who are you? What do you do? Yeah.
Okay. As you know, asking someone like me what I do is a dangerous opener, but I'll try and do what I would say to an average punter. I run a pretty sophisticated leadership development business called Switch On Leadership, which is attempting to bridge the world of conscious leadership, regenerative thinking, purpose, deep wisdom work, deep trauma-informed work. My business partner is a trauma-informed therapist. So we weave that into the big picture, complex problem solving, systemic change, innovation, disruptive innovation, AI. So we're really a full spectrum from deep inner to expansive outer. And we have a very beautiful curriculum that we take clients through. But we also do a lot of experiential learning rather than what I would call additive learning. We do transformational learning. We're not here to give leaders new added thoughts onto their existing minds, but transformative experiences, which is fun and exciting. And a lot of the tools we use are coaching oriented. we all do, everyone in the company does one-to-one coaching, and I specialize now, I'm kind of niching down my coaching into powerful men. And the way I like to say it is who want to fuse heart with smarts to meet the historic moment, which is for me, like my new niching of the male, my coaching work. But in all our workshops, we do peer-to-peer coaching and we do coaching circles where we provide the tools and the frameworks and the questions and the inquiries and the micro practices for the circles, which we call transformative circles. And my greatest product, my most innovative product, is a peer-to-peer coaching technology, which I wrote the first one 18 years ago in Goa one Christmas. And it's a codified way for any two humans of reasonable intelligence and competency to coach each other through six and then added sessions of fairly transformative coaching, which is still designed to be safe and not have the potential for what I think Freud called abreactions, you know, trauma pop-ups and difficult things that two people who are not trained really probably don't have the capacity to do. So I'm a massive believer in coaching. It's in everything we do. Although as a one-to-one coach, I only usually have two or three clients at a time at most. And I prefer to bring coaching into the world through process, through experience, and mostly through peer-to-peer. Peer-to-peer coaching.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we'll kind of maybe expand on some of these things you brought in our conversation. I'm going to talk to you about your coaching later on, but I'd like to ask you first about the world we're in right now. You know, like you said, meeting the moment. What is the moment we're in? Like, could you help us make sense of that? What do you see unfolding right now? It's a big question. So
it's massive. And I think I'm going to answer it with at least two lenses, two frames, maybe more. I often say to my new friends, when I hear myself saying actually two things, I then usually often say, usually I'm a three thing person. So I might pop another frame in as I go. So the first lens is the sort of, in some ways, the easier lens, which is we are in this transition between a modern industrialized nation state social economy, where it made sense to be a nation with a boundary and, you know, all sorts of rules and immigration rules and with lots of companies inside it, and institutions that are also quite discreet and linear and mechanistic and efficient. And then we are in between that, which worked really well for, you know, a few hundred years, and the science underneath all that, obviously, the sort of consciousness of science, and industrial scientific consciousness. And then we know that we need to be more sustainable and more circular. Migration means that these nations are kind of weird and don't really make a lot of sense anymore. We want to probably eat less meat and fly less and be climate adaptive and potentially climate collapse adaptive. And we might not want to live in very dry areas like I live here in essentially a desert that doesn't feel like one because it's so verdant in LA. So we're kind of between these things. And most of us are kind of, I still live and make money and function within this modern worldview, state, economy. I know there's something more, something's coming. There aren't that many examples of when it really works. I can't really see it. Is it co-living? Is it bioregional places? Should I live in Alaska because it's climate adaptive and we'll be growing grapes in, you know, Anchorage? So I guess one lens is we're in this tumultuous, exciting shift of our operating system, as I often call it. Like the operating system's upgrading. As I just said in the keynote before I came on, it's not like a neat thing where we can say Microsoft can have the new operating system and it just goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. We restart the computer and it's all, oh wow, this really did some great work here. We're like living in the code changing and we are the coders of the new operating system. That's a new way I think of putting it, which is amazing. You know, the Chinese proverb, maybe live in interesting times. I mean, we are really in interesting times. We are like in the upgrade. So I think that's one lens that I'm going to bring to it, is this sort of socioeconomic system lens and our operating system lens. But how we connected initially on this conversation was through another lens, which is interconnected with it, obviously, entangled with it, is this realization I've had, and I think many others have had, which is we've kind of pushed as far as we can on the individual as the unit of construction of the world. And there's a wonderful paper actually called The Invention of the Individual in Early Modern Europe or something, right? So we kind of invented this idea, or we can play along with this narrative that we invented the idea of an individual who has private property, which is the nation state's number one goal in many ways, is to protect the private property of its citizens, which is an individual. Although obviously that comes from Athens or whatever, it became enshrined in the sort of liberal democracy. And we sort of did individual, you know, in legally, and we did individual in coaching, right? And coaching is traditionally an individual to an individual experience. And in that, we also developed our minds to be individually as intelligent and complex and systemic as possible. So I got into systems thinking through scenario planning in the late 90s, did the training in scenario planning, which introduced me to systems thinking, which is still a modern project in its kind of analysis of flows of information, meaning, money, feedback loops, and all those sort of things. And it's, for me, still a mind tool. And what I've experienced in my own journey, and which I think we're experiencing as a globe through this transition between worlds, is that there's a different truth in the mind of the individual, which is more about the relationship between us and others. It's the space between the individuals, which is in some ways where we're realizing the answer is of something, or we don't even know the question, but the answer might be in the relationship. And not just in minds relating, but in bodies relating, which would you could call the embodiment turn, the embodied turn, or I would usually call it the regenerative turn now, because I see regeneration as a thought, as really what happens when systems thinking becomes embodied and in physicality, in biologies, in bioregions, in nature, in relationships with nature and each other. So a lot of my work in, as a theorist, if you like, in the last few years is about understanding the relational turn, which is something I actually read about in my postmodern philosophy degree around, you know, the relationship with the text. The author's dead. The text is the relationship. We're dialogically making truth. And in fact, I just posted on Facebook, someone sent me their master's thesis about regenerative leadership. So I went, oh, well, I'll tell you what, as I like to reciprocate, one of the tools of the age, I think, is reciprocity. So I dug out my master's dissertation from 1996, in which the last sentence says, we can't tell the truth ourselves, we have to tell the truth. And I literally, the last word of my dissertation was dialogically. This is like over 30 years ago, right? Oh, no, not quite 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago. So I guess a great challenge I've been living into since I was a young nipper at university is, what is this relational turn? I didn't get it then. I wrote it, didn't get it. I got it cognitively, that there is no truth. The postmodern condition made us realize that truth is a very dangerous thing to say, I've got the capital T truth. Particularly as a scientist, which is where most of that capital T truth comes from. I do have a slight complexity to that, because I do believe there is an underlying truth of existence, which is my spiritual awakening told me that. But how it manifests is still dialogical and relative, I think. So I think this relational turn, this embodied turn, this regenerative turn is the answer to the question, how do we transition to what comes next? And I'm a real believer, I'm like a kind of advocate, that talking about it alone and writing articles, which I do lots of, so I'm very much in the modern condition of writing thought pieces, it's a necessary fact of what comes next, but it's not enough. We have to live those theories and thought pieces in our bodies, in our relationships with our own body and with the bodies of nature, the bodies of water, the planetary bodies, whatever the bodies are. Never used this term, but so I'm really interested in that now. It's a relationship between, it's an interbodied relationship that is the answer to whatever this big question is, what's coming next and how do we align to it and who's creating it and how do we get there. And so when I see on LinkedIn or Facebook people theorizing and speaking from the theory of metamodern or post-postmodern or regenerative, but they're not showing up in the relational piece of that, I think it's just more modern, because the modern was always about criticizing itself anyway. That's what it did, right? The modern just becomes more modern, and when you go postmodern, which is postmodern still modern because it's criticizing modern, and then post-postmodern is criticizing postmodern, criticizing modern, but it's all still modern. And it's like we're trapped on the runway of modernity and we know we have to take off. And we think being more modern is the takeoff. Being more clever and more systematic, systemic and more, and writing more books. And I really know it isn't. It's a part of it, but the real bit is this body shifting how it aligns with you right now. And as we just talked about before we jumped on, what happens when you can allow your aliveness, which is usually crushed under a whole weight of beliefs, mindsets, cultural stuff, like we talked about living, growing up in Manchester or Thatcher's London, as I did. So many things crush the aliveness. I mean, it's, but when you allow yourself to find the aliveness in you and the other person can do it with them, which some, as we know, call divine eros or sacred eros. But I like the word aliveness because I'm working with people who don't talk about sacred anything or conscious anything most of my life. And so I don't like to use any of those languages. I like to use languages that everyone can get. So I talk about wholeness a lot with my clients who are like senior leaders in Fortune 500s, basically. I talk about wholeness, aliveness, and fullness. That's my trio of words that I can then unpack into regenerativeness, metamodern, conscious, blah, blah, conscious X. And those words everyone can sort of feel.
Yeah.
Like I don't like the word healing, I like the word wholeness.
Yeah.
Because healing has all sorts of funny words, things attached to it, right? So that's kind of, I guess, an opening gambit that we can think into the new world. We have to sense and feel and think and act into the new world. And I think that's what we're learning.
Yeah. Well, I was like jumping in because I'm so excited about what you're saying. And this has been a big theme on the podcast. And so just a few reflections, and then I have a question, which is like, and I've shared some of these, so forgive me for people listening who've heard these before, but like, I remember when we got into like integral theory and Ken Wilber's work, and it was so interesting, the intuition that myself and many of my friends had, which was like, you know, if there was this period of like elation and just being thrilled to expand our cognitive maps and sense of what was possible, and it did have a transformative impact on me. But we, so many of us, got to a similar place quite quickly, which was like, okay, that's great, but how do we live this stuff? And for many of us, that took us into a practice called circling at the time, which actually is a relational embodied practice, and brought me into contact with what I call the poetic attunement. And I think this is like, so what we didn't realize was that we kind of naturally found our way to what I think is part of what is emerging, this journey into the felt sense, into embodied life, not excluding the cognitive, but there's a way, and you write about this, and I want to link to this in the show notes. There's a brilliant paper that I read of yours where you describe how, you know, if we're not careful, we abstract ourselves cognitively out of experience, you know, and the modern mind, it kind of falls into that trap. So I'm kind of hearing this journey into aliveness, into wholeness, where we move out of a mindset of like lack, and even the word healing, you know, like there's a sense of something missing from the moment. We've got to seek it and find it. And actually, there's a different kind of embrace at the moment where we are attuning to what's here, and then revelation occurs, and we can enter into that wholeness and that aliveness. And I feel like this is like it's the one of the coagulations of like where we embrace our biological nature, our capacity to feel our felt experience. And one of the meta competencies of unlocking transformational leadership. So that all being said, like what I want to ask you is like, I'm thrilled basically. So I'm feeling relationally right now, a sense of aliveness and resonance. And so two questions, like, you say that the leaders you work with actually relate to these words, wholeness, aliveness, and fullness. That gives me encouragement, because even those words, I think a few years ago, people might have balked at. And how are you inviting them on this journey, basically? Like, what is that work you're doing to invite people on this journey you're describing?
So there are many answers to that question. So the first thing is rule number one of Leadership Development Club: meet people where they're at and then take them higher, hopefully, or deeper somewhere. Don't tell them they're wrong or they're in the wrong place. And it's one of the great challenges of the modern mind is it goes, oh, I've had an answer, which is sustainability or regenerative business or meta-modernity. You should be thinking it too. And in that moment, we, as you said, abstract away from them and their bodies, but also our own bodies. And as I wrote recently in a little bit of a LinkedIn, I don't do social media dialogues, spats. I think that it's a thin medium for this level of nuance and complexity. And you're abstracted already like five abstraction levels away from the actual body that's feeling what they're feeling. And I did sort of point out to someone who's fairly well known in this field, or the field of the change that's coming, that as soon as you tell people that their model, their worldview is wrong, you've abstracted yourself off the map, because you've chosen a place that is modern, which is the ideal place, you've taken yourself out. And you're saying that my preferred state, which is one of the great word framings of systems thinking, is somehow the right state. And we don't know that yet. We don't know whether collapse in the great architecture of nature, whether we're not actually the right species for this planet anymore. We don't know that. I don't know that. I don't know whether some type of turmoil in a Anthropocene world is going to open up a new species which is better adapted to this planet or to a new planet. We don't know. And anyone saying they do know has fallen into the trap of the abstracted modern mind that thinks degrowth is the solution or regenerative bioregions is the solution. It may be part of a solution to something, but even the premise is that we know the answer to it because we're a modern mind that's abstracted out from ourselves and our own complexity and, what's the word, collusion with everything that is right now. And so one of the things I often say to people in the systems space is, or regenerative sustainable space, is there is no way to be off-grid from the current economic system. Because even to be off-grid, you need batteries and solar packs that are developed by the system. And you're probably going to need toothpaste, probably, I'm going to suggest, or a toothbrush, unless your bark is really working for you. So you're always enmeshed in the modern system. And it's just actually really honest. If you've got money in the bag that's paying you to be doing some cool purpose thing, you're in the system. And you want your money to be worth more than it was 5 years ago, because otherwise you're losing money. So we're all in that system. So to anyone to say that they are, that have the answer, is, I think, disingenuous. And it's where a lot of the thought leaders in this space trip themselves up. And I think I've done it. I'm not saying this, I haven't done it. I used to be like, everyone should have a purpose. Everyone should have a spiritual experience of awakening. Everyone should do healing on their trauma. And if you don't, you're just not it. You're not living the dream of life. And yeah, there's a part of me that probably still thinks all those things a little. But I've had to be humbled by really grief, actually. That's a whole nother we could go off onto that. I had to be humbled by the most grief you could imagine, which is losing someone very close to me. They're alive, but I lost them. And that has ripped up me up into understanding myself and my body and my relationships in such a different way. But I'm going to pause that. There's a whole journey that I'd like to come back to around my journey into embodiment away from this thing. And then how to bring them together, because it's not like I don't want to have all this thing. This is great, this thing. I don't want to just sit there doing interoceptive attunement. I'll probably do some of that, but not just that. So how do I meet people where they're at? So first of all, I tell them I am like you. I may have had some breakthroughs that you haven't had yet. I may have codified what I've learned in my breakthroughs. I'm a total geek of transformation. So I've done all that work that you don't have to do because you're not interested. You're a geek of something else. But I am you. I am a fallible, flawed leader living at the edge of my capacity, what I like to call the growing edge, because it's got that regenerative sense of that little shoot that's growing. So rather than leading edge or bleeding edge or cutting edge, I mean, that's so, I'm on my growing edge. And I think I've got some stuff to share. But even when I'm doing a keynote, which is about as expert user, AB, parent, child as you can get in this work, which is usually the on-ramp into our leadership work as the keynote, not always, but often. I'm still talking about, I'm on a, what I call a footstool, not a pedestal. So I have a whole article actually, if you're listening, on Medium it is, called Why Gurus Break Brad. And it's about sort of spiritual narcissism, personality disorders in the spiritual integral world and all that stuff. And in it, I talk about the desire that the hierarchical modern human has is to put someone on a pedestal. And there's reasons for that. And I get it, fully get it. I've been asked to be on one my whole life. And I have always refused as a guru, and that's why I don't have a following. I have people who are interested in my work, but I don't have like crazy social media numbers and like people on my every, because I don't I am always putting myself down, but not onto the floor, because then no one can hear you. In this metaphor, no one can hear you or see you. You can't teach from the floor when there's just heads in the Sangha. But if the Buddha, the next Buddha is the Sangha, then we need to be able to go on the floor, disappear into the unity field of one of all of us together equals. But then when someone's got something to share, they sit on a footstool just above the level of the head. So you can now see me, but I don't ever think that I'm rising up above you as a guru, right? So because the crowd should be able to bring you back down and someone else should pop up. Now this doesn't fit well with the modern business model of the guru, whether it's spiritual, thought leadership, whatever, because that's all about building a platform, building numbers, selling your book to those people, whatever. So I've struggled in this role. Don't know how we've gone to this topic. Oh yeah, so what I'm always saying to my leaders, I am you, but I just got a few, I'm not gonna deny my strength and power and intelligence and awesomeness, but neither I'm gonna trip out on it. And then another way of answering your question is, I mean, so many ways I've learned to reach the Fortune 500 world with this work. But one of them is bringing science into it as much as possible. And also being clear where science stops because of its nature as what its project is. And where we're now talking about wisdom or metaphor or story or mythos rather than logos. And just, well, I use those words. And then, not very often, with you. And then I have woven it all together in this biotransformation theory. And then I got books, which helps as well, having a book. No one reads them, but I think they're helpful to give you some credence. And then our programs are all like a mixture of getting all this depth, you're getting all this thing, but you're also doing two things really importantly. You're always practicing this practice-based leadership development. And my business partner is a practice ninja. So we're doing embodiment practices all the time, but we don't call them that because that weirds people out. So we sometimes say we're doing embodied leadership practices. There you go. Micro tools, micro practices. And we don't label them all with weirdness and we don't over-complexify, but then we do explain if someone asks. And I've got lots of lovely slides of moving interoceptive things with a little quote from Antonio Damasio, but then a thing from a trauma therapist. So we're weaving, we're just constantly trying to work out how do we bring all the bits we've got, which is visuals, story, science, facts, practices, tools. We've got also one-page tools that you can print out and you just how do we bring it all? Workshops, virtual, peer-to-peer coaching, circle-based. Circling is so powerful, this circle technologies. How do we bring it all together to get people from A to B, basically? And we know that not everyone's going to go there. And I'm very at peace with a leadership group of 50 people having 10 pop breakthrough. They're loving it. They want more. Another 30 really enjoying it, got some stuff out of it. Some of it went over their head, but they're moving, they're grooving. And 10 probably just going, I thought that was bollocks, you know, or whatever, right? I'm super at peace with that. Now, I know that I can work on that to get that 10 down to maybe 5, maybe 3, really through changing me, not through changing the work or anything, changing me to be totally available to everyone. And that's the relational field stuff that we can maybe deep dive in a minute on. And so as I've become more whole myself, I've gone from probably being a 50-50 Marmite person, because I was like creative innovation guru, blah, blah, bing, bong, blah, blah, to maybe being like, I don't know, strawberry jam person, which most people like. And like is a weird word. I mean, most people can get with it. And there's some strawberry jam haters, and I'm okay with that. And because we work in the corporate space, I have a very clear, like I call it the church state division. And what I mean by that is, it's a really a responsibility for this work. If you're coming to us as an individual client working with myself or my business partner, and you're paying yourself, you'll get full open kimono, ask anything you want, go into the metaphysics, go into the deepest conversations. Do you believe in entities? Do you believe in blah, blah, blah? Go there. We'll go there. We'll take you on. We'll do deep trauma, whatever. If your company is paying, which is state, not church, then you don't have full choice on whether you show up. Not really, because it's expected. And sometimes it's actually mandated in a leadership program. Then I think there's a very, it's fuzzy, but there's a boundary on how much trauma we can talk about and what that is all about and process, how much spirituality and metaphysics we can process. So my business partner and I, who've co-created our whole business, we have other people all involved and associates, but my business partner and I, she comes from the body. She was an elite gymnast, choreographer. Then she got into sort of therapy through dance for teenagers. It wasn't called that, but that's what she was doing. Then she became a craniosacral therapist, biodynamic. Then she got into coaching, and then she met me. Meanwhile, so she was moving into the mind from pure body, really. And then I was coming from Cambridge, medic, science, philosophy, and I got fibromyalgia when I was 20, which then said, yo, body, hello, head walking around. You have a body and it's hurting. And it's hurting bad, it's hurting every day. So that was like the beginning of me getting more into the body and then finding new practices and tools. And then we met. And then for the last bit of time, we've woven our theory together and our work together, our practices and our worldviews. This woman is also my wife, spoiler alert. So this is a very live experience. It's happening every day. And I'm answering this, I'm saying this because one of the other things we've done in our work of meeting people where they're at is helping people come into their body if they're more of a body introverted person. And it's not just all about, if I just got a guy asked from my client group today, you know, how do you, this is about delegation, how do you delegate to someone who's an introvert, who's not stepping up and taking power? And I said, well, you know, American companies like yours or American HQ companies are very much focused on the person being the key leader of the group, of the world. And I've learned that the quiet person who takes a while maybe to get the cognitive lenses and or just doesn't want to get all that detail, it's not their world, is often thinking and feeling and listening in a different way to the way I have traditionally done. And that's just as important information and sense making and leadership style that we need. So I've learned that. And then one of the rules we have on stage, if you think of, or like, is we don't do metaphysics on stage. So biotransformation has a metaphysics under it. This is our theory, by the way. So we have a curriculum and tools. Then we have biotransformation, which is our best way of underpinning all those tools with science and with wisdom and with embodiment and trauma and somatics and storytelling and whatever underneath it all. And underneath that is a thin layer of metaphysics. And we don't talk about metaphysics on stage because it's conjectural. And so Alison and I have one of our metaphysical things is she actually has some kind of idea of spirit guides or entities or teachers that I call Bill and Bob in a slightly funny way. And she discusses things with them. I tap into my body and I get a sense of what we would call intuition. Metaphysically, whether it's an entity or not, it's actually irrelevant to the job of leading, which is being able to sense that information that's maybe not analytical and maybe not local, non-local, non-analytical, and then knowing whether it's an instinct of fear and survival or an intuition of love and purpose and wholeness. That's the important bit we teach. What sits underneath it is conjectural, as the Buddha said, right? If there was one. So we don't go into conjecture, and that helps us stay in this world, but be bringing all this depth into it. So I won't use the word divine eros on stage. If a client at lunch says, yo, that aliveness you're talking about, I've read this book about divine eros. Is that what you're talking about? Happy at lunch to talk about it. Because it's just my story. Yeah. What I'll talk about on stage is the feeling of aliveness and how beautiful it is and what it can do for you. Let's practice how to feel it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's funny, my business partner and I are similar to you. My business partner has guides, which he uses to make decisions in all kinds of places, including our business, and actually often very, very effectively. And I'm more driven from working with my felt sense. So like feeling something in my body, like feeling a resonance, a sense of eros in relationship to a choice and a lack of it in another direction. And I'm impacted by what you share about not kind of coming to people and saying this is the way, you know, like this is, I think that's important. And you mentioned grief as well, like that feels really important in our times, that we're able to process our grief, and actually that's an essential part of the of transformation that's occurring. I think what comes up is a sense of like in the coaching sessions you do and that your partner does, what is guiding the transformational process there? Like how do you invite people into a greater sense of wholeness and aliveness? Because, you know, and this is what I'm also curious what you say about this is like, because I'm sat with, on the one hand, you know, I've read a lot of Dave Snowden's critiques of, you know, people who say like, this is a new kind of leadership and, you know, I've got the key and you need to come here and I'm better than you. It kind of gets into some of your critiques. But on the other hand, you know, there are clearly some things breaking down and some things emerging and, you know, some ways that feel more wholesome, more responsive, more wise. So how do we meet and be in those together? So I'm doing a bad job interviewing now, but kind of two questions.
No, I get it totally.
And then how do you invite people into that wholeness and aliveness, like in the moment?
Kind of like the footstool again. If you don't have a footstool to sit on and have anything to teach or share, or then you don't really have a job in the modern world. There's no transaction that can occur when I say I'd have nothing to give you. Someone has to feel that you have some teaching or some insight or breakthrough that they don't have. Otherwise, you can't really do any job of coaching, whether you call it coaching as a traditional coaching transaction or a coaching style or being a teacher who is a coach. Whatever, coaching has to be premised around, I have something that I can give you. Now, it may not be an answer, hopefully it's a tool or process, but I really know that process. And so I can take you on that. I'm not saying it's a like designed process, ours is, but that we do more intuitively now. But there's a structure of what we do, very deep structure, which we call the transformation curve, which I can share now in a second. You have to have something to give, or there's no role for you in this conversation. So I often go, as a pseudo-anthropologist, I often go to the sort of tribal layer to check things out. One of my frames. In most tribes, from my understanding, there is some kind of king leader position. Though, as David Graeber wrote, is it David? Yes.
Yeah.
In his last book, that in a lot of tribes, there's a dynamic between when times are tough, we might have a slightly more hierarchical king leader type. When things are easy and good, we can be more collaborative. So we kind of circle and lines, as I often call them. They're both useful. We call them in our work control and protect mode and create and connect mode. And they attune to these two big brain networks, the default mode network, creative, connective, empathic, imaginative, and the control executive control network, which is predictive, algorithmic, problem solving. And you can see them, this is fractal. In all society, you have times where hierarchy is good, where modern thinking is good, and times where relationship and connection are good. And I think right now as a world, we're like so obsessed with control, linear, hierarchy, that we really need this more than anything. We need to recalibrate it with this. So what we do is we invite our clients essentially onto their own transformation curve for this session or this project or this period of coaching. But one of the things that we're very clear on is that it's their journey along the curve. Now, I might have an intuitive sense of where they might end up. I may not. I don't always at the beginning of a project, or I haven't given myself enough time to listen, or I don't know them well enough, whatever. But I know the curve is always works. And I came to the curve, by the way, through innovation work. And then I realized it matched onto the coaching sort of process. And then I spent the last 10 years getting this curve fully mapped out in my brain and in writing. So you can read about this in my books. And the transformation curve is a J, not a U, because I believe that when you go through this process of letting go, of grieving, of releasing old, healing trauma, wholeness arise, and then when wholeness comes, aliveness, and then comes fullness, and then creativity, it takes you somewhere higher in the metaphor than where you are now. It takes you, and we call that higher, more fitted with the outside world. So it's an adaptive evolutionary experience, right? So you don't come back to the same place, you come somewhere that's more fitted. If you allow that breakthrough to come through and you embody it over many months, often years, you come to a higher figuratively place than you were. And I don't mean higher elitistically, but higher, more adaptive. We call the word fitted, not fit, which is the modern form of evolutionary theory, fitted with the world. There's no morality in it. It just fits better with the complex, crazy climate change, AI, blah, blah, world we're in. So what happens on that process, whether it's a group or an individual dynamic, is we think this is the blueprint of change in the world, this transformation curve. You see it in everywhere. You see it in how nations go through political turmoil to get to more democracy. It gets worse first. So the curve, is this looking the right? Am I on your left side?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So the curve goes like this. It starts to decline as you realize, or you don't realize yet, that your patterning is not fitting and you're using old stuff that isn't working. So you're declining from fittedness. Then if you're lucky and you know what you're doing and you get a coach or whatever, you choose to go, what am I doing here? What's going? And you heal and you grieve and you cry and you release and you go deeper into your awareness. And then something happens down here where you connect with something. We can talk about that in a minute. And then you come up with some new insights. You're like, I got it. I've been using this model. And then you build some strength in that. You try rewiring that, and then you get somewhere up here. What happens if you don't do that is nature takes you down anyway, and then you decline and you go bankrupt or your career dies because there's no aliveness. So the up is this aliveness coming back up with newness. And so we're very aware that that process is like the architecture. Didn't make it, clarified it maybe, and we've got lots of tools that can help you on it. That's the bit that we offer. And one of them, which I'm going to feel like I need to share, is I think maybe the most important. I just recently shared this with my old business partner who does similar work, because I listened to Schwartz of Internal Family Systems on stage.
Yeah, Richard Schwartz. Yeah.
And I actually think we have a nuance that is additive to that, that is actually a contribution to this conversation. So we've been using parts negotiation for 20 years in this curve. Right, you're negotiating with the different parts here, and then as you go down, you're meeting new parts or shadow parts or unopened parts, archetypes that you don't know about. You can use the different words, right? And the one that we talk about is the connector. So that we've got the protector and the connector. And these are these two modes again, and two brain networks. So they're always these dualities. And in our deeper work, in our more surface corporate work, surface is not the right word, in our more less developmental, less trauma-informed versions of what we do, we use the term control and protect mode. What does that want you to do? And create and connect mode. What does that feel like it wants to do next, right? When we're doing a more deeper experience, and what I mean by that is like an hour journey with all our people in a room closing their eyes for an hour, having some kind of musical, often guided experience, which we do usually in the church form where people are paying themselves to come into a big workshop, 300 people in a room with music, and I'm DJing and my wife's doing breath work and whatever. We use a different terminology, which we use the protector and the connector. So the protector is the bit that protects you, we know that. But the way I like to frame it is the protector can help you stop having what you don't want. Threat, death, abuse, neglect, blah, blah, blah. But it can't get you what you want, which is connection, resonance, aliveness, wholeness. That's the connector. So what we do, I think this is the contribution, is when we're taking people into these states, so one-to-one, that looks like close your eyes and we're going to do a process, group, close your eyes and we're going to, often with music, not always. We spend a lot of time getting the connector archetype aware, the client aware of the connector archetype, what it feels like in their body. And you can do things like safety or imagine this or the wisest part of you or the Gandhi inside you, whatever works for them. You know, you have to find it a little bit first, help them find it. And then what you do is you ask the connector to bring up whatever it feels you are ready to have a breakthrough in. And this is where you avoid trauma popping into the places it's not meant to be. Because the connector inside everyone is the part of the guru, it's the inner shaman, the inner guru, which knows the wholeness. It has the imprint of wholeness in it, or aliveness, or fullness, or any other of these terms that you like. And without knowing it, people will then bring up something that is ripe and ready to transform, and not this thing with their dad that they're not ready for yet. Which is where the coach might push you, or the therapist might push you. So then we get the connect. So we're really a facilitator of your internal connector doing what it knows how to do, which is finding the right therapist, coach, book, program, religion for you right now. But the way we talk about it, it allows, then the connector can persuade the protector to let go a little bit if it's ready. And there's a whole process, obviously, we do that. That's standard parts negotiation. Or inner child that holds that protector part of you for that bit of trauma. Mm. And then the protector might go, I'm not ready for that yet. Sorry, I need that defensive mechanism right now. And you go, okay, we'll come back to it another time. And so you've pushed into it, and then you've not gone into the content.
Yeah.
Which is extremely important. And we've actually learned over the years as coaches, my wife is a therapist, but I'm a coach. You don't have to hear the story from the inner child. You don't have to have the facts on the ground of what didn't happen and who didn't do anything to have transformation along the curve, which is why I can take 50 game A alpha leaders on these journeys, because I don't need to hear all the story, because they're hearing, they know it's all in them. They're doing all the work. We're just taking them on a journey. So it's not even coaching anymore, I don't think, or maybe it's what coaching really is. I don't know. Mm. But it's, and the more you understand this curve and where the things block it and where the modern mind likes to try and get away from the curve. So one of the, I call them anti-transformation tropes. And one of them is make X great again. You know, make America great again. It's like, can't I just be like I was in my 30s or my 20s, just, but now and better? Because I didn't have kids and I was super cool and running around Manchester, Amsterdam, whatever. That's one of the tropes of trying to stop the natural process of transformation. There are others, you know, a few. So in a bio transformation, we've got 8 principles and the transformation curve is number seven. And that's because there are 7 steps. So we try and make it simpler for people to understand this architecture. And the 7 steps of the transformation curve is principle 7. And you can kind of, you could say 8, you could say 9, you could say 6, but there are kind of 7 interesting stages along this process. And you can track it in individuals. Companies do the same thing when they're going through a transformation process, right? The same thing. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers much of the question. And it also keeps you humble. Talking to Dave Snowden's critique, but it also gives you a role to play. Otherwise, what the hell are you doing in this conversation? And once someone knows their own transformation curve and how to help themselves through it, that bit you don't have to do anymore. They're on it. They're doing it, right?
Yeah. Fascinating, because, you know, internal family systems is exploding in popularity right now. Maybe has been for some time, and it's an effective modality, and I use it in my coaching. It's powerful. And so I'm really fascinated what you say about the connector. Because one of the things I found potent about that practice is you disidentify from parts, and then, you know, you access what they call self, but I call presence, you know, which doesn't need to be, you know, necessarily, a fully realized embodied presence that you can find at the pinnacle of spiritual traditions. It can be, but can also just be a simple experience of feeling centered and, you know, free in that moment. And that being with the protector and the exile part from that place is what allows for the integration to take place. You know, presence and self can give the love and presence to the, those parts, and they feel
exactly secret, right? It allows the disidentifying first, because there's something, as I would say, bigger than the part and the fear the part is trying to protect from. Now that bigger, I would metaphysically say, is non-dual experience,
right?
But you don't have to have the non-dual experience, because you've kind of already got it in you. You know, the Buddha nature is in everyone, right? The seed. And the connector is the seed. And if you can create a relationship to this connector, because people all, I don't know what it is, even the most yang modernist can feel it, and they know it's big. They know it's limitless and infinite and has bigger potential than any pain. Particularly to give that framing, obviously.
One of the reasons I think IFS is exploding right now is because it's one of the best modalities, or let me say one of the modalities that is helping us do that move you're talking about. You know, that one of the ways we get caught in our kind of thinking and rationality is through over-identification with these parts, with the thinking mind. And, you know, they're spinning around, moving away from things we're averse to, trying to attach to things. And IFS, first of all, it helps you integrate parts. And my belief is that they actually, I think Dick Schwartz thinks differently, but they can integrate and go away. And then you're building that kind of energetic structure so that you live in presence more, you get less buffeted around. Anyway, you're expanding your bandwidth. But they're also, it's like a meta practice of like awakening, you know, of like,
absolutely.
Like, you do it enough, then you start to go, oh my God, like I'm more than just the those parts. You become psychologically more fluid and expansive.
Your palate opens right. up to all the colors.
Yeah. And so, no, like in these times, it's kind of a no coincidence that things like IFS are exploding in popularity. They're kind of like the one, it's one of the lubrications of, I think, you know, again, maybe I'm falling in the trap of like saying, I know where there's something better and people should go there. But, you know, a lubrication of a kind of transformation that's occurring. And so my question then is, therefore, like, what is the connect? The connector's different than self, like, because I love this. It's like an imaginal, you know, imaginal archetypal connector.
I call it an ultra. I think the protector and the connector are the ultra archetypes.
Yeah,
like the archetypes, the two archetypes, of which all the other gods and goddesses and archetypes are fragments or versions of, maybe in some way. And people love it. What was the question? Because I got to say something about this
Go there first if you want. My question really is, there first, and then I'll come back to the question.
Okay. I love relational things because I'm alive with something you said, but you've moved on, and then I'm like, I don't want to go back to this thing that was alive in me. And you can negotiate, right? When you're not personally affected, you have some disidentification. This doesn't matter, it doesn't matter if it's clumsy, it's not clumsy, it's just we are working with what's alive and we're big people with big minds and we're also trying to be useful for the audience. And it's a lot going on, but you can hold all that and you can say, oh yeah, you speak. Oh no, okay, I'm gonna. It doesn't have to be also shameful and everything. So the transformation curve, looked another way, is disidentification with whatever over-identified version of me, pattern. We call it pattern because it's neutral, but you could call it, sub-personality that I've been using so much. You disidentify from it, which has allowed you to go into this more oceanic / potential presence possibility where all the things are. So you could call that an imaginal realm, right? If you're like Alan Moore, the amazing graphic novelist, he wrote a feature book called Promethea, which I recommend everyone read, which is this whole thing, platonic realms, archetypal realms. You go into the sort of pool of all the things because you're no longer attached to that one sub-personality. And in our work, by the way, we call our sub-personalities things that are lovingly light-hearted, honoring their strengths whilst also slightly giggling about what they are. So my wife and I often, so there's a part of me which we call Hampstead, because I grew up in Hampstead in London, which is the slightly posh, snobby, upper middle class Jew version of me, right? Where I like design things and I like to be in business class and I like to be, she's got one called Laguna. That's her version because she grew up in Laguna Beach, which is also very similar, right? Non-Jewish, but she might as well have been, right? That's one of our little sub-personalities, right? And so Hampstead is awesome in some moments. And then there are other parts of me coming through. So one of them is I'm working into is called Akira. And he's like my wise mage archetype that I'm constructing, actually. Well, I would say co-creating with this imaginal realm, potentially. And I don't want to get too much of the metaphysics of collective unconscious and are they real? I don't know. But I certainly know they can be playful and useful. And so Akira's helping me. So anyway, as we go down, we disidentify with that one part. And what you said, and I've just got a new discernment that came to me because I've been thinking about this, which is, I think, the inner child version, the seven-year-old, and I can see him in that room when my stepfather said X, and that part can disappear. And in fact, in the work we do, in the last part of an integration session, we ask that part to grow up in your mind, going to university, blah, 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 and then joining you, and now it's no longer a part. So that's where I think I agree with you that the parts can disappear, because they're no longer having to be separated, fragmented, discordant. But the archetype that part represents, yes, Akira or Hampstead, can stay with me forever. Because that's amazing to be discerning about design and interested in sensuality and in the beautiful things and going to Michelin star restaurants. Big up you. But if that's all I've got, I'm a very brittle man indeed. And I think most people have only really got one sub. Most people, when they start this work, have got one sub personality, which is they think is all the ones they've got, it's all they're ever going to get. And what the joy of this transformation work is, there are, I don't know if limitless, but there are certainly a heck of a lot of options in there. And this is where I then would come back to developmental stage theory, because I'm actually a kind of soft developmental stage theorist, not hard. So developmental stages is one of the biotransformation principles. And it's principle five, because we look at five stages for leaders. And this break, the stages almost show you before you're there what transition might look like. I talk about major key and minor key breakthroughs. So a major key is usually a developmental stage where you're like, it's so big that everything has suddenly been recontextualized into this newer way of seeing the world. And I think they do point to specific transitions of specific parts of us and of society that must be disidentified from a bit for a new one to come in through that curve and come up and become more dominant. And one of the ones we talk about is a regenerative transition. So we've got one. So the big transitions for us as leaders is from achiever to innovator, which is really the modern transition of going, oh, I can actually break the rules and change the rules and challenge the rules and disrupt the rules and become an innovator in my field, and no longer follow the rules. And that was the great modern inventor, scientist, Da Vinci, yada, yada, Thomas Edison. Then often people get stuck there. That's sort of like the Tesla one. And then the next one, I think we and they're just a story. So just a story, but just a story with some depth is where we go from what we call innovator to transformer, which is where you get purpose and you get that there's something bigger than your idea and your innovation and your genius, where you can actually guide transformation of the world. If you allow your purpose to hook into your clever disruptive vibe. And then the one I think I'm living through at the moment, maybe early stages, I'm 50, so I'm early stages of this, I'm probably ahead of my time slightly, ahead of my own time, I don't mean ahead of the time, is what we would speculate, because I haven't lived through, I can only talk about what I've lived through, but I speculated in my last book that there's a stage where you go from transformer to regenerator, where you get this aliveness turn, this natural turn, this bioregional, to whatever you want to call it, where you get something different. It almost goes to a more wild and sensual place that's also more old, you know, pre-modern, tribal, animistic. And I think we're living through that as a nation, as a world, as a global right now. This so if you think about the Transformers, were all maybe the last 50 years post-war, maybe quantum theory is a transformer. I don't know. And we're now being invited by nature to go a whole nother thing, where this is the shift between being clever systems thinking, writing my books, doing my podcasts, to this relational thing where, oh my God, I have to actually be in a sensual, interdependent, reciprocal, emergent, non-controlled, but still very confident, boundaried, but also semi-permeable bits of you coming in, maybe a bit of dependence again. Like I'm in a truly interdependent relationship. You are a little bit dependent. Otherwise it's not interdependent. You have a little, what you do does affect me, but what you do is you, and I don't have to be taken by it, hooked by it, absorbed by it. So it's a very long answer to a simpler question, but yeah. That this developmental stage thing is definitely a compelling narrative. I do think it's, I mean, you see children, you know, the Piaget plus, you see children go through these stages. You really do, as a father of two. And I just have the hunch that adult stages have stages too. I think they're archetypal. And I think this IFS or parts negotiation tools is one of the great tools to have these transitions. And that's why we're so interested in them. And I'll stop talking now because I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think... I'm inspired by what you share. It's like, I don't know if you know Jeremy Johnson's book, Seeing Through the World, where he writes about Gebser and talks about integral consciousness and contrasts it to how Wilbur would talk about integral consciousness. And, you know, this is like one, I think one of the kind of critiques he's making in that book is that, you know, Wilbur in a sense, you know, I feel like kind of funny saying this because Wilbur's such a giant and, you know, had such an impact in my life, but his critique is like, he's still perhaps in that game of mapping, you know, mapping things out. There's a kind of perspectival game afoot there. Whereas Gebs's view on integral is something more emergent and holographical, where that space, that need for that kind of spatial analytical mapping falls away. And there's a kind of transmission, you know, an embodied Gnostic exploration.
Right. So it's more like, wild. Because I haven't read Jeremy. I know Jeremy. I've read a little bit of Gebs's big book, but I will be honest and said I stopped because I don't have time for such.
That's why I read Jeremy's. He's like a tiny version of it. Yeah.
This week I was reading Jeremy on a website talking about this aperspectival and the Gebsarian view. But would you call it, in my language, would you call it a wilder?
Yeah, so this is the emergence. Yeah. This is why I started to bring it up, because it's like as you were speaking, I was feeling, you know, where it, so it begins to incorporate some of the magical, mythical kind of way of being, where there's like an imminence and a wildness and rawness and a Gnosticism where it's like, you know, you know, we're being, our hearts are being broken open, and that's why our grief is so important.
That's why, exactly. Oh, so, that's super interesting, because as I would see, if you've got this wild, you know, the wild man in the woods, shaman archetype, but it's pre-modern, you don't have the maps and the mapping of the Aurobindos and the scientists, you know, the modern desire to map, which I love. I'm a mapper. I mean, bio transformation is a map. When I know that the path, you know, Krishnamurti, the truth is a pathless land, and yet there is a path, or there's, I mean, I don't know, the metaphor breaks down because it's now words, right? And I'm feeling it. Like there is some, oh, I know, you know, when you, that Indiana Jones bit where he's looking at the crucible of the cup of, you know, the Last Supper cup, what's it called?
The Holy Grail. Yeah.
And he has just to walk out on this empty space. It's one of the great bits of cinema, I think. I saw it my son.
The bar.
Maybe what I'm saying is there is a path, but it's also pathless. I don't know how to say it, because I feel like this bio transformation work has come to me. I didn't ask it to. I didn't think to be a theorist. It kind of came to me. And for me, it is a map of a territory that doesn't exist yet, or something, or an archetypal map. I don't know. But I do really get the pre-post-trans fallacy that if we go into the wild man, neo-shaman, neo-animist world without all that distinction and discernment of the modern mind, that's not it. So when I see the people bringing in some beautiful human being from a forest in the Amazon and like all hail to the tribal shaman who doesn't live in a 55 million person democracy where healthcare needs to be solved and water policy, it's a mismatch for me. And it's a fetishization of the thing we want, but we don't want it. That's not where it needs to come from. They might, that's not saying they don't have teachings and things, that's wonderful. Because they might have ways to get that seed, super seed in us. I'll come onto this new idea I've got called super seeds. Where they might have a way to resonate that super seed in us of that particular piece of the imaginal.
And the relational piece. I think that's
and the relational piece. Covering. Exactly. And just get us going, hold on a minute, you're so out of it, you're not in relationship. And we need to come to whatever metamodernism is trying to become. And I think it's something that is, I think my critique of metamodernism is it's still modernism because it hasn't got this wild relational, sensual. Can I hug you in the room? Are you someone who can theorize and then can also open up your heart to have a hug and laugh with me and cry and grieve and laugh at how insane and funny and hilarious we are? For me, that's the relational test I have of thought leaders, is can you be a humble nutter in the room with me, as well as a great mind. It's not the only test for sure. It's not like the, you know, the Arthur and the sword, but it's pretty reliable for me. And then we also should talk at some point about personality disorders, because they really mess with this relational field, and they are very dangerous, I think, in the world right now, actually. And I think I'm becoming more aware of that by the day, but we can maybe come into that another time. But this thing that Jeremy talks about, I think, if it's the same thing, is for me, it's this regenerative turn is not about, we need all the maps and we need all the analysis and we need all the clever models. I love models, I love frameworks. We need all that. We do need all of it. So unbelievably complex, this reality we've created for ourselves. And no one human being can do it without maps. You need frameworks. And we need to be able to turn to that simple question, what is alive in me most now? Which also there are traps in that, because what in life could be your desiring, not sensuous, but like sensual, or maybe the other way around, I had to work it out. Yeah. I want to have sex and orgasm and take
hedonistic
drugs.
Kind of.
Hedonistic. Yeah. Or even like, I just want to laugh in a field, or I just want to get naked in the woods. It might all be beautiful, but it's not appropriate for what's alive in me right now, because what's alive is often quite scary, which is scary to the protector, which is, I think I have to give up this business model and not write books. I don't know, whatever it is. That's what's alive in me most now. And you're like, oh God, that's so inconvenient. And that's, so we talk about in Biotransformation 8, we map the connector and protector felt senses and scent and feel. So we look at instinct, protector, urgent, survival, information, non-verbal, becomes verbal, but feels alive, believe me, versus intuition, also feels alive, but it's a softer, it's that poetic attunement, I think you were talking about. Then emotions, we'll go to the next level, like there are protective emotions that get you moving away or towards, as you said, craving or avoiding. And then there are other emotions that get you in relationship and relate and help tweak you to, like, shame and grief, for example, like they're tweaking you to be here. And then thoughts go between analytical thoughts, ideas, versus imaginative thoughts, which are the connector way of speaking, or like write this book or draw this or go and do a pottery class at the weekend. You're like, what? You know, those. So it's all just a map, right? Or it's a framework. But it really helps, because if you just go to what is alive in you right now, you can actually distort the field quite quickly if people don't know what you mean, or they're sensing something that isn't, that's pre-transformational rather than post-transformational or something.
I mean, that was my critique of some of the circling environments I was in, where I was like, you know, I was like, wow, this is an amazing relational practice. But sometimes you could spend hours like in these big groups, and then things would kind of devolve to the lowest common denominator back into, and you know, you would sense there would be, and then sometimes something kind of transcendent or you know, like interdependent but like elevated would come through, and then, you know, and then boom, and then it would collapse again into some kind of traumatic response or something like that. And so you know, I do think there's a need, and of course, like, that's not to critique people when they get triggered, and
no you
know, but like, I think you're making an important distinction that this aliveness, it's not just aliveness at all costs. It's like there's a discernment in that aliveness, you know?
And yeah, I feel it coming in and through me rather than discrete in me. It's interdependent. And what you just said, actually, I just want to double click on what you just said. So I love circling, and that's why we use circles in our work. We do like hour and a half circles. But I also am a believer that a facilitator, so there's a whole debate, you know, in the art of hosting or whatever about, do you have an agenda or not as a facilitator, as a coach? And that's why these tools are helpful, these frameworks, because I have an agenda, which is if I can get this group through a transformation curve, don't know the content of it, that's their world. I don't want you to become a banker or a green activist. That's your, I don't know that content, but I do want you to go on the curve. And so if you allow the group to go down into this dysfunction and it starts to dysfunction and disintegrate because it's now too peer-to-peer, it's too chaotic, and it's there's no structure or hierarchy at all anymore, and we flattened in that forced flatness. It's like the green meme in the room, yeah, at the moment. It almost certainly disintegrates because there are personality disorders in the room, almost certainly. There are people with very little real experience and of themselves, and they don't have that much wisdom. And so if you let it all go there, you just get into, and I often play this clip from Ken Loach movie. I laugh because, you know, good Northern socialist. And there's a movie about the Spanish Civil War. I think it's called Bread and Freedom or Bread and Roses. I can't remember. But I often play it in my collaboration classes, leadership programs, classes, you know, because it's this bit where everyone's sitting in a circle and they're all different factions of the People's Front for the Liberation of Barcelona and the Barcelonan, you know, syndicalist, blah, blah, blah. And they're trying to work out what to do with this thing land they've just taken from the fascists. Meanwhile, the fascists are all aligned, under control, bombing them right now. And that for me is a beautiful metaphor of the line in the circle not being able to come together, because a good group press process should have quite a strong facilitatorial, not just in the space holding, the feminine, but there's a role for the masculine in a circle, and intention. So we call them loops in our corporate work or systems work, lightly engineered, outcome-oriented processes. We have there's engineering, there's design, and every minute of our workshops are designed. Like, it might be chaos for 10 minutes, but we design 10 minutes of chaos in, if you know what I mean. We are willing to give up the design at any time if there's something pregnant that needs to be, definitely, but it has to really be a hot potato that needs to be taken up in that moment. That can't be then put into another session. And outcome-oriented, we do have an outcome. We're being paid to have this experience. And I think some of these practices, if they don't have a bit of engineering and a bit of outcome orientation, a bit of masculine, they often can devolve. You might have an amazing one, and then four ones where you're like, do I really have the time? And if you get older and you don't have that much time and you're a parent and you're running a businesses, I don't have time to be in dysfunctional group processes.
Yeah.
Like school groups that are trying to be too flat, or co-living groups that are trying to be too flat, or I just don't, they're low resonance for me. They're low frequency. They're not as good as they could be because they're all feminine. They're all circle. They're all peer, and they don't have enough leadership.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it can be interesting to be in a space with people where you take away all, you know, I've had people start those groups where they don't even say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody's just in, like, it's like an encounter group. No, you know, and then
it's like post-voyeur therapy. You just sit there.
It can be fascinating, you know, because people then start like, what the fuck is this? What are we supposed to do? Like, are you the leader? What? And so people are like,
you totally,
know,
totally.
And then the skill, you know, and then I've seen the leaders skillfully navigate that, and it goes somewhere incredibly beautiful. But I totally relate to what you're saying. Like, there also is this, the world is burning outside, or like, yeah. I'm not young anymore. I have limited amount of time. Is it the most skillful means in that moment? So, just knowing that we're coming to the end of our conversation, you want to add, there's a couple of things I wanted to bring back quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
But you want to say something first. Yeah.
Just on that thing, sometimes we start a leadership program with a similar thing, which is, we leave them a room and set up in a weird way, and we're not there. It's 8:30. That was the schedule, first day of a 2-day workshop. And then we turn that into a learning process, right? You know, so I think if you design it in again to have the chaos, and you've got skillful means, you turn it into something beautiful. But if that's all you've got, it's just one modality, right? This chaotic, self-organizing, it's an experiment. And then we can unpack it. But it's not the only modality of facilitation and coaching, I think, is that
it can invite people into that place we're talking about, that kind of emergent, embodied,
definitely
inside out leadership, where people suddenly drop in and they're like, oh, I'm in my full felt sensory mode. And, you know, like all the socialized parts of me have fallen away.
Totally.
I've met, but not through any kind of trying to get somewhere or be anything,
yeah.
but through just this act of like being with what's here in this moment with you, being authentic and vulnerable. When it's at its best, you know, it's an incredibly potent practice that invites you into that space. And, because I do want to name a couple of things like before we finish, which is like one, totally with you when you said about parts. Yeah. Like for me, parts contain a virtue inside of them or, you know, qualities of presence, essential qualities. So that I think you're right. Like when a part is met in a certain way, that's what gets liberated. It's like, and then, you know, what I would have asked you about more is like, then I think that's where we want to identify with that, like that archetypal energy, you know, is something we can play being in the moment, you know, not that we have to be it all the time in a rigid way, but
that's the key. Like,
yeah. It's just, it's contextual. But like, yeah, we can identify with that. And then interesting things start to emerge in our leadership.
Definitely.
But the other thing is this connector thing. I'm like fascinated by it and we won't have enough time to go in it, but it feels like, because that, I think that's one of the things about IFS is it's brilliant, yeah? And it's a certain system, yeah? So it, you know, it what it can do is kind of give people a sense of like, that's the only way parts work works. Or, you know, right. You don't have things like connector parts,
yeah.
Things like that. You've got exile parts and firefighters and protectors. But then, you know, like there are these other types of parts and entities we can meet. And so... what is my question? First, I just love it. And so I hear this like it's an archetypal part. And so you invite people to connect to the, my practical question is, what do? Do you invite people, hey, imagine now there's a connector here.
Yeah, totally.
It's like a wide, yeah, totally. And it knows what you need in this moment. So just what does it look like?
You're planting a, you know, post-hypnotic suggestion, essentially. And we often use music in all our deeper transformation work. And we have different music for protector and connector. And we have different music for different roles the protector and connector are playing. So we have music for connector allowing you to grieve music. So parts of Mahler, some cinematic music, you know. Then we've got music that is like, blah, 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 we're going to integrate ourselves together and go out to the world with our integrate. And then we have like the bittersweet sorrow of life, the wry smile of what a doozy this crazy world. Yeah. So when we're building over a longer program, like even a 3 or 4 day workshop, we start slow. We're giving people some of the information. We're giving some science. We're giving these two modes. Then we're telling them actually the modes could be seen as parts or uber parts, and then those parts can show up in your sub personalities, and then there's archetypes, and so we start to build like a kind of palette of tools that you can help people understand for themselves, and same with our coaching work, and then we start to play deeper games with those parts and those archetypes, bigger games, bigger stuff, and then we, in a 3 or 4 day workshop, we aim, and we've never not done this, we aim to have a big, two big musical movement-based processes. One is the down into the sorrow, into, we use quite a lot of kriyas, you know, movement-based things to get into those patterns, to access the pattern coming away and dying in the oneness, essentially, but I don't use that language very often, but as Al-Ghazali, the Sufi mystic said, the happiness of the drop is to die in the river. So the drop is the part in this thing, a fragmented protective energy that's been working away tirelessly for years. And now you're criticizing it after because it's annoying you because it's addicted or it's whatever. And you like love that part. And it just goes, oh, I can be part of the one again, which you can call self or presence or whatever. And then we do another session like a day later where we do like more of a canvas of kind of what's possible if I had access to all the parts. We don't use that word all the time, but if I had access to all parts of me and the world, what am I building and what flavor is that? And that might be the archetype that you want to play with for a bit longer. And we're very, like you just said, we're very clear that you're sort of building, like your Dungeons and Dragons, you're building archetypes that you can use that are connected to you, your life. Like, oh yeah, I was always into this. You know, there was personal biography in that. And then you have like 10 leadership archetypes you can use in a given situation. Oh, this is what I'm going to use, this feminine softness, and just be silent and listen. This one, I'm going to lead everyone through the bushes with a big hacksaw clearing the way because that's what's needed right now, whatever. So, but the connector for me is both, and I'm going to flip into another language now, is both Atman and Brahman, if that makes sense. It's the personal version you have of the shaman guru learning modality part of you that wants to be whole. It's the Buddha nature. But it's also the grounded being as well. And depending on what group we're with, we'll tap into that fully. Like you are now tapping into the great chain of being, Indra's net. I don't know. We do a lot of work in China and India. So we play with Taoist words, the river. We'll play with Brahman. We're trying to make it always local in some way. Or we'll give people 10 versions in a meditation that they can then pick the one that feels good, or just choose your own one, right? And our imaginative capacities, which is a connector, are so amazing that they, if you're given the right question, you'll pop in with a little leprechaun or a dandelion or a hummingbird, something that for you is what this thing is, which you can then draw in your mandala afterwards, which we took from the breathwork holotropic people, you know, this man trying to map the Jungian mandala of that experience so you can remember it. And then you might want to buy a hummingbird handbag to bring that part of you in during the day more, anchor, whatever, you know. So the connector for me, in summary, is the version of you that's most whole and learning and wise and listening and observing all the time. And it's the liveness. And the protector is this amazing survival aliveness that's like, just get to the next day, next moment. Who cares about wholeness? Just get to the next moment. And that takes precedence. And that's beautiful. In my first book, Switch On, I write, the protector is the bit that keeps us to the next moment, to have a next moment to have transformed into, but the connector is the bit that's going to do the transforming and has all the bits you want for a deeply meaningful life.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really beautiful. I hear, like, you know, a sense of ensoulment. We talked about that before we put the recording on, but... you know, this archetypal and almost like the generation stages of tantric Buddhism where, you know, I've deconstructed an identification with a certain personality. You know, I'm accessing presence but I'm also, you know, I'm also bringing into kind of being an ensouled or unique expression of presence, or the different flavors, the way that presence can show up through me as a unique being, you know, and so, yeah, that's really, really rich. And I think
that's the regenerative turn you just described.
Yeah. Right.
You return, you come from the oneness with your unique, you're both world soul and self soul. You're interdependent and you're both me, modern guy with one life and stuff to do and a purpose and ting and, you know, all that, and your world soul coming through me at all times and I'm attuning to it, and you're both and those things. And that, I think, is the stage of development as individuals and a society that's the invitation now.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen to that.
Well, yeah, you know, amen and other forms.
Maybe that's a great place to bring this part of our conversation to a close. So where can we find out more about your work, Nick? I'd really appreciate being here today.
So switchonleadership.com is the site that is now, we've angled it more towards just corporates. We used to have the personal development stuff in it and it was confusing everyone, to be honest with you. So switchonleadership.com is a leadership business. Best place for me as an individual is LinkedIn. It's the one I put most effort and time into. And Nick Jankel with a J is probably the best place. And I'm very open. I'm not, I don't play the mysterious guru archetype, which is, I think, an issue in the world today. I'm very available. But I'll also be very clear if I don't think there's anything alive in the conversation, because I am very short of time. So I am available to conversation. There might be something pregnant between me and you, audience listener, between you and me. And sometimes, you know, these relationships go in and out of, like we mentioned, Greg Thomas. I had a furious burst of WhatsApp dialoguing with him for a few months, and then we now check in much less regularly. There are moments. And I will say this, and this is maybe a good segue to a future recording, is I'm in the middle, as I'm going through this developmental stage, as I my story of it is called, I am looking at a new, not just business model, ecology of business with some various collaborators. And I think I'm calling it the Rhizome, and it's very exciting. It's very alive for me. So connect with me on LinkedIn, because the leadership business is going, is now no longer fully me. It's now its own entity that is going forward into the world. And I have other parts of me that are playing in other projects, other ideas. Dark Retreats is one, and other things. So lots of things going on. And then, yeah, that's probably the best thing.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches, because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.